Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, September 23, 2015, during a live Teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's Teleforum conference call, as today we'll be discussing the pros and cons of civil juries. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to have with us today two experts, Professor Renee Lerner. She's a professor of law at the George Washington University School of Law right here in Washington, D.C. And she'll be joined by Professor Sujet Thomas. She's a professor at the University of Illinois College of Law. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of them of about 10 to 12 minutes. Then we'll have some back and forth between our panelists. And then, as always, we'll be looking to the audience for your questions, so please do be ready with those questions when we get to that portion of the program. But for now, to get to our program, Professor Lerner, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, and thank you all for calling in, and especially to the Federal Society for putting together this teleforum, Dean Reuter and Jack Neblett. When we think of civil justice reform these days, we often think of discovery. And so this topic of civil juries may seem to many of you to be unusual. Well, there's a good reason why discovery is often targeted for reform, and I'll have some things to say about that. But even more important than discovery is who is supposed to be the ultimate fact finder. The shadow of the jury in our system has shaped not only trials, but the whole of civil procedure in ways that many of us can't even see because we're so accustomed to them. In theory, jury trials are the way we decide civil cases. And yet, jury trials today constitute less than 1% of civil dispositions in federal and state courts. And that is despite constitutional provisions, both federal and state. This fact becomes less surprising when you consider the fate of civil jury trial around the world. The U.S. is just about the only country left that even claims to hold civil jury trials. Civil jury trial either never existed or has virtually been abolished in every other country. Even England, the birthplace of the civil jury, and its former colonies of Australia, New Zealand, and Canada have abolished the jury for almost all civil cases. There's a reason for that. Civil jury trial, by its nature, has major drawbacks as a means of adjudication. This was always recognized from the very beginning of civil jury trial in medieval England. No one expected a group of 12 laypersons to be able to decide disputes involving complicated facts, multiple parties, multiple claims, or complex remedies. To enable decision-making by a jury, the system worked hard to radically simplify disputes. The English common law developed various ways to try to cope with the shortcomings of juries. Pleading rules and the writ system limited the number of parties that could appear in a single jury case, the number of claims the parties could make, how complicated a claim could be, and what remedy was available. So cases that went to a jury generally concerned only two parties, one claim for money damages, and one or at most a few simple questions of fact. Well, obviously, many disputes were more complicated and could not adequately be resolved this way. English judges developed entire separate systems to handle more complicated disputes, with decisions not by juries but by judges. The main alternative system was equity. The system of equity decided many important cases, including questions of mortgages, bankruptcy, fraud, trusts, and business associations. Equity was able to administer more complicated remedies like injunctions, besides giving money damages. The Seventh Amendment is based on the distinction between common law and equity. The amendment states that its requirements concerning jury trial apply in suits at common law, not equity. So right away, there was a large group of important civil cases that was not subject to jury trial. Americans at the time of declaring independence valued the civil jury mainly for a political reason. that is, nullifying hated British laws that they didn't have a say in making. After the revolution, that political reason became much weaker. After independence, the American people formed the federal and state republics and governed themselves through elected officials. The representative function of the jury therefore became less important. Jury nullification turned out to be deeply problematic in a self-governing republic. In the New Republic, state juries were well known for sympathies toward debtors and verdicts against creditors. In effect, they nullified the laws of contract. This alarmed James Madison, and he worried that these verdicts would discourage the investment that the New Republic so badly needed. In fact, in the Virginia Ratifying Convention, he argued against the need for a federal right to civil jury trial. And Alexander Hamilton did the same in the Federalist No. 83. There was a great difference of opinion among the founders about the civil jury, and that's unlike the criminal jury. All of the founders agreed that the criminal jury was important, and it's found in the body of the Constitution. But about the civil jury, there was great disagreement. Well, after the founding era, judges and legislators began limiting civil jury trial. And they did so in many ways. Meanwhile, American lawyers had slowed down jury trial tremendously in the adversarial system. And changes included extensive procedures for selecting jurors, especially voir dire, which actually doesn't exist in England, elaborate rules of evidence, dueling expert witnesses, exhaustive cross-examination, and long, complicated instructions to the jury on law. Representatives of the people complained bitterly about the burden of jury service to jurors themselves, their families, and their work. The final blow to the civil jury was the merger of the systems of common law and equity. This began in the mid-19th century and continued into the 20th. This is what happened. Equity conquered the common law. That had to be true because only equity could handle complex cases. But the result has been the virtual end of civil jury trial. The old common law restrictions on cases going to a jury are gone. Now juries can hear cases involving many parties, many claims, and complicated issues. Few litigants want to take their chances with a jury in such a case. After the merger of common law and equity, parties have many ways to get information before trial, all taken from equity. That is, depositions, document discovery, electronic discovery, interrogatories, all of what we call pretrial discovery. This information helps parties to settle and makes trial seem unnecessary. Well, pretrial discovery is often, of course, a huge component of litigation expense and needs to be controlled by judges familiar with the case to be effective. There are many problems with settlement in the shadow of the jury, and we can talk about some of those if people would like. But in short, to put it mildly, a settlement often does not reasonably reflect the merits of a case. So what do we do now? The constitutional provisions concerning jury trial block the proper development of adjudication. The cleanest and best thing would be to repeal them. Assuming that repeal is not going to happen anytime soon, however, there are sensible ways to interpret many of these provisions. Suits at common law in the Seventh Amendment originally meant suits between limited parties for limited numbers and types of claims for money damages. We can go back to that. The legislature can determine the rest. Then what? Then we should set up a system for proper judicial adjudication. And there are many examples of how to do this right from other legal systems. The English, the Germans, the Australians are not barbaric or anti-democratic because they don't use civil juries. Other countries are well aware of the main danger of judicial adjudication, the biased or corrupt judge, and they take steps to guard against this danger. And I'm just going to mention here a few things that can be done if you don't use juries. One of the most important, and one of the most important safeguards against judicial bias in countries that use judges to decide cases is having a panel of judges. the panel of judges that decides a case in the first instance rather than a single judge. And these panels allow colleagues to correct a biased judge. And besides, several heads are often better than one at legal decision making. A single judge is not the only alternative to a jury, as many proponents of juries assume. Another important point, and an advantage that could be gained if we don't use juries, are that judges could focus on different points in separate hearings and address threshold questions first. If a defendant is not liable, there is no need to hear evidence about damages. Discontinuous proceedings like that are not possible with lay juries. It's not fair to keep asking lay juries to come back to court at different times. The jury requires trial of all issues at once, with related confusion and waste of time. And such sequential proceedings should help judges to control discovery. Judges can order and be more active in guiding discovery on each point as it arises. Parties should no longer be able to inflict or threaten to inflict horrible costs and delays on each other with little gain in knowledge of relevant facts. And the final set of things I'm going to mention, improvements that could be made without the jury, are written opinions by judges. Judges must give reasons for what they do, reasoned decision making, that can be thoroughly reviewed on appeal. A thorough appeal is a vital safeguard in legal systems that rely on judges. And appeals in these systems are often very thorough, and that's something that we in the common law systems don't understand perhaps as thoroughly as we might. And that is that appeals in other systems are often de novo, with no presumption of correctness attaching to the decision below, and a fact and law. So these systems are thorough in guarding against error on the merits. Our very limited appeals, in contrast, are a legacy of the jury system. We try to control inputs, such as what evidence the jury hears or the judge's instructions on law, but there is little control over outputs, that is, the correctness of the verdict. So I will wrap up here and simply say that timid reforms will not solve the many problems with the civil litigation system today, and it's time to think boldly. And now we'll hear from Professor Thomas, who also thinks boldly, but in a different way.
Thanks. Thanks to the Federalist Society, especially Dean and Jack, for putting together this teleforum. It's a pleasure to participate in this discussion, including with Renee Leto-Lerner, whose work I've enjoyed reading and citing over the years. So I'm going to talk about the upsides of juries. And as an example, I will begin by talking about the SEC's civil insider trading case against Mark Cuban. Cuban was tried by a jury in 2013, and the jury found him not liable of insider trading. Now, since then, the SEC has shifted more and more matters from juries to administrative agencies. Currently, something over 80% of the SEC's cases are decided in administrative agencies versus a decade ago when less than 50% of the cases were decided by administrative agencies. And the SEC actually wins 90% of the time in administrative proceedings, which compares to only 69% or so of the time that it wins in federal court. And so presently, there are several constitutional challenges to what the SEC is doing in shifting these cases from federal court and juries to administrative hearings. So in talking about the upsides of juries, I will start with why moving matters from juries, like in SEC cases, is problematic constitutionally, and related to that, why the founders placed juries in the Seventh Amendment. And then, for those who don't believe history should govern in this manner, I'm going to talk about why the jury is the best decision maker. So I want to start with the Seventh Amendment. The Supreme Court has said that the Seventh Amendment applies to the federal courts. And I also think there's a good argument that it applies to the state courts. But regardless of that, almost every state has its own jury trial right. But because my argument about incorporation of the Seventh Amendment, and also for simplicity's sake, I'm just going to talk about the Seventh Amendment during this call. So the Seventh Amendment states, and Renee talked about this a little bit, but I want to just fully state what the Seventh Amendment says. In suits at common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. And the Seventh Amendment is actually the only place in the Constitution to refer to common law. And the Supreme Court has said that common law in the Seventh Amendment is the English common law in 1791. 1791 is the date the Seventh Amendment was adopted. And so the court has said when we're looking at when there should be a jury, we need to look at the substance of the English jury in the late 18th century, and that's when there should be a jury. So as Renee talked a little bit about, in the late 18th century, the division of authority between judges and juries was for juries to decide money issues, and judges decided other matters like specific performance. Judges and juries were supposed to check one another. Alexander Hamilton stated, for example, that there was fear that judges could be corrupt. But beyond this idea of bad actions by the judiciary, in other words, and this is an upside of the jury to protect against bad actions by the judiciary, the jury was actually to protect against other bodies. And so the jury was to protect against the executive. For example, there was concern about improper searches by the government, and the founders wanted citizens to be able to sue the government for matters like that. There was actually also concern about the legislature, and so the civil jury was supposed to protect against the legislature. So James Madison talked about juries being able to nullify laws. Alexander Hamilton talked about if the jury was established, when they were talking about whether the jury should be established, they said if the jury was established, the legislature couldn't control where a jury right existed. So we have these protections that the civil jury was to provide against the government. But in addition to providing protection against the government, the jury was to provide protection in private matters. So for example, as Renee mentioned, juries provided protection for debtors against creditors. So if we go back to the example I'm using here, the movement of cases from juries to administrative agencies, it's problematic constitutionally because these were cases that involved money issues that juries were to decide. The jury was intended to protect against protect people against the executive, as one example. So I also said juries were not just intended to protect against the government, they were intended to decide other types of cases. And so I want to use employment discrimination as an example. This is a cause of action that didn't exist in England in the late 18th century. So I might say Congress should determine who decides these cases. But the division of authority always was for juries to decide damages. And as I said before, judges were thought to be biased in some ways, possibly towards some parties and against certain parties. And we actually potentially see this happening in employment discrimination cases, which are factually intensive, but are being dismissed on summary judgment at a very high rate, over 70% of the time. So let me put aside history for now and address, if we're looking at juries with an evolving view of the Constitution, whether there are upsides to juries. And I assert that the answer to that is yes. Juries are the best decision maker that we have. Available. And that has to do, one, with the incentives. So you can contrast the incentives of judges and juries. Juries do not have the same type of incentives that judges have. For example, judges in state systems are subject to re-election, at least some judges are. And obviously the influence that has on them in their decisions. We look at other state judges that aren't subject to election, as well as federal judges. The incentives that they have include promotion, and so their decision making may, in fact, be influenced by promotion. And then that's one point about juries being the best decision maker. A second point, it regards biases. So we know actually that judges and jurors actually share bias. Judges and jurors are all human beings, and they actually have similar decision-making. There are several studies about this, including a study that shows that judges can't disregard inadmissible evidence similar to jurors. But even though judges and jurors can have similar biases, one of the differences between judges and juries is that jurors' biases are checked by the requirement to deliberate with other people, as well as the goal to reach consensus. And so that is another reason why juries in our present system are the best decision maker that we have. And then the final thing I'll say about judges versus juries is that there's a lack of diversity in the judiciary, and juries are more representative of the community. And so I think that's another reason why juries are the best decision maker that we have in the system. I want to say just a couple words about the executive and the legislature. They similarly have incentives that juries don't have, and there are fewer checks on their biases. And I go back to a little bit of history. James Wilson said, regardless of problems with juries, because they knew that the juries weren't perfect. But he said they are the best body to decide. A jury could never grow into a dangerous system. And so I want to go back to the example. The jury is the better decision maker in the circumstance of the SEC. There are incentives and biases of the executive that are skewed in the SEC cases. The executive is both accusing and deciding. There are several Wall Street Journal articles about this issue, and in one of them, a judge was criticized. They talked about the issue of a judge being criticized for not finding for the SEC often enough. And this judge ultimately resigned. And this is just one example of the problems we face when we take juries out of the system. So I think I'll end there for now. And Dina, I'll turn it back to you.
Okay. Well, thank you both for your comments. I want to revert and have some back and forth, but I want to revert to Professor Lerner and give her a chance to respond to Professor Thomas. But as you do that, I'm wondering why doesn't for you and for all of us, why shouldn't this discussion sort of begin and end with the Seventh Amendment? That is that don't all the policy arguments here against the use of juries get swallowed up by the constitutional right to a jury, at least under certain circumstances? And I'm also curious, I think I heard in Professor Thomas's presentation something that's never really occurred to me, and that's almost a separation of powers perspective or take on the use of juries. And Professor Thomas, if I've mischaracterized that, I'd be interested in that. But when you talk about juries as a protection against judges and against government, you're able to sue the government with a jury not on your side, but a jury deliberating, protection against legislatures and the idea of jury nullification, it almost adds up to a separation of powers argument, at least in my mind. So I'll put all that on the table, and let's hear again from Professor Lerner.
All right. There's a lot there. One thing about the Seventh Amendment is that, of course, it hasn't been incorporated against the states, at least currently. I know that Suja argues that it should be, but it has not. And so the states are free to decide what rules they want about civil juries. And nearly all of them, as Suja said, have protections in their constitutions or requirements of civil jury trial in their constitutions. There are a couple of exceptions, but basically all of them do. But I think it's important to remember that civil jury trial hardly exists today. And so in many ways, these constitutional protections have proved to be, or constitutional rights, have proved to be unavailing. And we need to seriously ask ourselves why that is. And I would suggest because of the grave shortcomings of juries. And I mentioned that there is a distinction, in English law at the time that the Seventh Amendment was ratified, between law and equity. And that the more complicated disputes involving many parties and complicated issues of fact and law went to judges and not to juries. So the sole test for whether something was a legal issue or an equitable issue, that is, whether it went to a jury or to a judge, was not only whether it was a suit for money damages. Cases in equity also could decide issues of money damages. So that wasn't the sole criterion. There were other factors as well. And I think if we return to a look at the difference between law and equity in interpreting the Seventh Amendment, we would find that, as I said, suits at common law were generally between two parties for a limited number of issues. There were limited claims, generally one, and generally limited issues of fact involved. And I think if we return to that interpretation of the amendment, we would have a great deal, or go to it, we would have a great deal of flexibility. I would say with respect to Mark Cuban and the SEC, as I understand it, those cases that the SEC was bringing in federal court were criminal cases. And so those
They're civil, yeah. They're actually civil.
They're civil? I understood that there are prosecutors involved and so forth.
No.
Well, there was a lot of talk about prosecution in the federal courts. But I would say that I do think that criminal cases are a different matter from civil cases, and that in criminal cases there is more of an argument to be made that lay participation is necessary. I would say, too, that the problems with the judiciary that Suja mentioned are significant, and particularly in states that elect judges. And clearly a major priority of any law reform has to be cleaning up the judiciary and improving its independence. But even so, there are ways to check bias still using judges and not juries. And there are the ways I mentioned involving panels of judges in the first instance. 3 to 5 judges are typically used in a significant civil case in the continent of Europe. And also, as I mentioned, that thorough appeal, which you really cannot get with a jury. So I would mention that those two things are quite important. And I would also emphasize that increasingly cases are quite complicated in the issues that the fact finder is supposed to decide. Much more evidence is in written, numerical, or scientific form, and that becomes very difficult for many lay jurors to handle. So I would leave it at that for the moment.
Okay, I want to go back once more to Professor Thomas, if we could. But before we do that, let's open the floor to questions and people can begin to queue up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So we'd like to open up the discussion to others. If you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting to see who lines up, Professor Thomas, would you argue that, you know, I think Professor Lerner cites some statistics and argues that people really aren't using jury trials. Is there an argument that you would make that just the existence of the possibility has some of the beneficial effects you'd argue are inherent in a jury system? That is, even if people aren't using juries, the mere fact that they're there provides some benefit. And do I go too far in sensing in your original opening statement some sort of separation of powers issues?
Yes. Thanks, Dean. So I do think, as you said, that even if people aren't using juries, that there is some benefit to their existence and the possibility of using the jury. I do think that a lot of cases go to federal court and they're not decided by juries. So it's a lot of the stats that exist out there are using cases that are actually filed in federal courts and then in state courts and saying that only 1-4% of those cases I was actually using criminal cases as well, but less than 1% of the cases that are actually filed are actually being tried by juries. So I think people want to use juries. Sometimes they settle, and that's fantastic, but sometimes other things happen that prevent them from using juries. As to your question about separation of powers, you're exactly right that I'm effectively arguing, and I actually have I'll do a brief plug, but I wrote a book that's coming out next year, early next year, called The Missing American Jury, Restoring Its Fundamental Constitutional Role. And in that, I argue that the jury is effectively a branch of government. And then if I may add a couple more points, Dean, is that okay?
Sure, go right ahead.
Just to Renee's point about equity versus common law. I mean, it's clear, I've written about this extensively, that money issues went to juries when they were not decided by equity courts. And Jim Oldham at Georgetown has written about this as well, and others. And so there's this clear division of authority. Yes, every once in a while, very, very rarely, was something decided by equity, but that was extremely it was controversial. There were a few very, very distinct issues involving trust that could be decided by judges, and damages could be decided. But it was extremely rare, and there were these very, very discrete categories of cases. And then just two other points. With respect to the Mark Cuban and other SEC cases issue, Gene Eaglesham of the Wall Street Journal has a series of articles that started in the fall of last year and goes through now about this issue, including the current Seventh Amendment challenges that various lawyers are bringing on behalf of their clients who have been forced into SEC proceedings. So anyone who's interested in that can read about that. And then finally, I'll just say on the complication matter, that these cases are complicated. I think complex cases are actually a really small part of the federal and state dockets. Discovery costs are probably the best indicator of complexity. There's actually a Federal Judicial Center study that shows most cases aren't complex. So, for example, they looked at discovery costs in closed cases on the federal docket, and the median discovery costs, including attorney's fees, were $15,000 for plaintiffs and $20,000 for defendants. Including attorney's fees. So the typical case isn't a complex one. So I think even if we do have some type of problem, that is with juries deciding complex cases, which I don't actually believe, but if I actually conceded that point, the fact is that that's a very small set of the cases that we have that could be decided by jurors. So I'll end there.
Well, once again, our lines are open. We have quite a few people on the line, but we don't have any questions pending. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We're happy to have you join the conversation today. And let me ask you, Professor Lerner, as a myself as a lawyer and as a litigant, there are many circumstances where I could imagine that I would not want a jury deciding a case, especially if I were a defendant. I mean, we're all familiar with the expression runaway jury. I don't think we've talked about corrupt judges, but there's not the phenomenon of a runaway judge. I'm interested in your thoughts on the option of a jury and what that means for settlement, especially in some of the, even if they're not complex cases, a lot of the sort of little guy versus big guy cases where a jury might over-empathize with a plaintiff in any circumstance, the defendant would have more incentive to settle a case.
Yes. I mean, there certainly has been a lot of studies showing systematic bias on the part of juries in favor of individuals against corporations in particular. So there is that systematic bias in the jury, and there are also biases involving localism, local or in-state parties tend to be favored over out-of-state or foreign parties. So those are built-in biases. By option of a jury, do you mean the ability to waive jury trial? Because that does currently exist.
No, I'm talking about a defendant being forced into a jury situation. Is that a possibility? And even if it's not, what does it say about jury trials that defendants so often want to have a bench trial rather than a jury trial? They don't want to leave their fate to 12 peers, quote unquote.
Yeah, exactly. And because of these systematic biases on the part of juries that we've discussed. And it's interesting that when the civil rights laws were drafted, they were drafted with the thought of avoiding having, for example, black litigants having to face majority white juries. So there's another example of jury bias that can affect cases. So there are these kinds of systematic problems. Judges, of course, may have their own biases, but I think they are easier to check because they must give written opinions. Particularly if there's a panel, it's easier to check them. But even a single judge has to give a written opinion about findings of fact and conclusions of law. And that opinion is subject to a much more thorough appeal than a jury verdict is. So I think those can certainly be benefits. I think in general, we would be able to have a much more streamlined and efficient system of litigation if we were to move to judicial decision-making for some of the reasons I discussed. In fact, you could even abolish trials altogether. There is no word in French or German for trial. They call it a proceeding, a procès in French. And the idea is that the judges are going to decide issues sequentially and not have to have trial of all issues at once with confusion and waste of time and so forth. So there are just a lot of advantages that would result from using judges in thoughtful ways rather than juries.
Again, if you have a question, our lines are open. Push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Our audience is unusually reticent today. Professor Thomas, do you agree that the bias, especially some of the localism biases in judges, are more easy to check than juries? I'm thinking of judicial hellholes, and these are state court judges, areas that I think are identified primarily with a judge or two that become the jurisdictions in which the plaintiff's attorneys will file big cases against out-of-state defendants. What do you have to say about all that?
For the most part, I think that it is not the case that jurors and juries are more biased than the other possibility, that being judges. I'll make one comment. This is somewhat separate but related, that, you know, trial judges trust juries. So if you talk to, if anyone asks a trial judge, and I don't think it's a company line, I really believe that trial judges trust juries. They may take cases away from juries, but I think they take cases away from juries because they think they're required to do so under the rules. So I think, you know, they're the ones who actually know juries better than any of us because they spend the most time with them and they trust juries. In terms of judges versus juries, one of the points I'd make is, you know, with judges, there's no, for the most part, right, on an everyday basis, there's no outside challenge. That is you can't come in and say, for the most part, hey, judge, every judge in a case isn't screened for conflicts. That judge decides on his own or her own whether to take the case on. Of course, there can be challenges to the judge, but it's not done often, and there's obviously a risk to doing that. Contrast that with jurors. There's no assumption that any juror can decide a case. Instead, the jurors are you know, very much questioned as to any possible bias. And there are, as we all know, both for cause and peremptory challenges available. So you have this extensive screening mechanism that's an outside challenge, you know, that can be made to jurors, but nothing like that with respect to judges. Instead, judges themselves are checking themselves. With, you know, obviously there's some exceptions to that. And I just read about this case. So I can only say a little bit about it, but there's a case called Tolan, which involved police abuse. And the parties actually, the judge had apparently made some comments, and the parties tried to get the judge off the case, and the judge would not step off the case. And then, you know, the parties ended up settling, like, right at trial. But do I have any doubt that the parties settled at a different number than they would have otherwise if the judge hadn't been on the case? I think that's the case. And they didn't have the ability to just kick the judge off the case. So judges, even in this particular recent case, I think we see an example of the difference between a judge and the jury.
Professor Lerner, were you going to add something?
Yeah, if that's all right.
Please go right ahead. We do have a question from the audience, but we can get to that after your comment.
Okay. About judges saying that they like juries, many judges will say that, particularly in public. They will say that jury trial is a great thing, and they will say things like, juries try really hard to get it right. Right, that's a line you hear very often from judges. And some judges, you know, may really think that. I've heard privately from a number of judges that they think jury trial is, quote, crazy. That's a direct quote from a federal judge. But I think one of the reasons why judges support jury trial, at least in public, is first of all, they like to sound democratic, and that certainly does sound that way. And second of all, it relieves the judges of a great deal of work and responsibility. It is hard work to sift through the facts of a case and actually decide a case, and to write an opinion saying why you decided a case that way. It's quite difficult. It's a lot of work. And I think judges are just as happy to shift that burden to juries. Of course, juries don't write opinions, but they decide a case one way or the other in the rare instances where they get a chance to. But what you see judges doing, many judges doing in practice, is diverting cases from juries in many, many ways. So in practice, many judges are not happy to have a jury trial and to have a jury decide a case. They will kick out a case in various ways, through the pleadings, motions to dismiss, or through summary judgment, or more often simply by the parties settling. And judges, of course, many judges vigorously encourage settlement. So in practice, that's what you see. So there's a bit of a disjunction there between what judges will say and what they actually do. In terms of challenges to jurors who might be biased, peremptory challenges challenges for cause are certainly necessary, I think, in the jury system to remove those jurors that might be biased. But there's a tension between those kinds of challenges and the representative function of the jury. So the idea that the jury should represent the community in deciding the case, there's a tension between those two things that I think many proponents of jurors need to address. Another thing I will say is that trial lawyers' skill in picking a jury matters a lot. And lawyers will deliberately, of course, try to choose jurors they think are favorable to their cause and try to eliminate jurors that aren't. And sometimes this has nothing to do with the actual bias of the jury. It might actually have to do with the impartiality of the juror. So that's another difficulty.
I do want to turn to the audience in just a second. We've got one question pending. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let me make a quick commercial announcement for a couple things we have coming up. Our next scheduled teleforum call is tomorrow at 12 noon Eastern Time. It'll be our update on the CFPB And then Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be previewing the Supreme Court's term with regard to class action cases, so some jury implications there. Also, our National Lawyers Convention, November 12th through the 14th this year, is the registration page is now available on the Federalist Society website. Among other panels, our Corporation Securities and Antitrust Practice Group will be looking at the use of ALJs by the SEC and other agencies. So do check in with our website. Today, of course, we're talking about civil juries. Let's take our first caller question of the day now.
Thanks. I was actually going to ask a question that was addressed a little bit already by Professor Lerner, but I was thinking about what I've heard even from practitioners who often say, exactly as judges reportedly say, that they are inclined to trust juries because jurors typically try really hard to get it right. And I was thinking in the same way about what I actually observe about how that statement of belief is actually represented in the behavior of practitioners. And I was thinking about the way in which the putting a question to the jury still, it appears, involves a significant roll of the dice in the sense that you just don't see a lot of cases going to juries. And so I was just wondering, maybe both of you could address this, you know, a little bit more than you already have, just how, if it's true that juries try so hard to get it right and typically get it right, or, you know, insert whatever sort of statement of faith in the jury that you want, why do so many cases nevertheless not go to juries? Why do we not see that sort of in practice, in actually trusting them more?
So this is Professor Thomas. So I think that clearly some of those cases, as you are aware, are settling. Clearly, some of those cases are, as Professor Lerner mentioned, are being decided on motions to dismiss and motions for summary judgment. But what I will say about that, and I briefly said this previously, I don't think that that's against or contrary to saying that judges believe in juries. I think judges believe in juries, but they also believe that they're required to follow the law that the Supreme Court and their courts of appeal have set up for them. And as a result, they do their best to actually follow that. And in doing so, they end up deciding motions for summary judgment against parties. And as a result, that also ends up having cases not go to juries. So I don't think that's inconsistent with judges actually trusting juries. And then in terms of practitioners, I think there's some set of practitioners who trust juries and some set of practitioners who don't. And sometimes it is divided or very much divided along the lines of at least large corporations versus individuals. And I guess I'll go back to the point that I think that this issue was decided when the founders set the jury system up in the Constitution. And that's the system that we have. And I think it's one we should trust.
Go right ahead, Professor Lerner.
Oh, I wanted to address the issue of settlement in the shadow of the jury, because I think that's some of what the question was asking. Is that right? That you're...
Yes. And I guess, and the one thought that just sprang to mind with Professor Thomas's answer there was, if you do in fact have a situation where one side typically really trusts the jury and the other side typically does not, is that really a sort of, does that suggest that maybe there is some partiality at play there?
Yeah. I think there are a number of problems with settlement in the shadow of the jury, and that's, of course, the way most civil cases are resolved these days. Part of it is, as you're suggesting, a systematic bias. So in favor of individuals against corporations, for example, although there are other biases as well. So that's one problem. But there's often a lot of uncertainty about what a jury will do, including about the likelihood of different outcomes. And so that produces some interesting results in settlement. And then there is also risk aversion of particular parties. So particular parties might be less or more risk averse, and that affects settlement very much, apart from the merits of the case, and even sometimes parties' ability to understand the risks as well. A huge factor, too, are the costs of litigation today, and in particular, the lack of a fee-shifting rule in most cases. So this creates enormous pressure to settle. So thanks to the American rule, in general, the losing party in our country does not pay the winner's litigation costs. And so even a party with a good chance of success has great incentive to settle to avoid the costs of discovery and jury trial. So I think because of all of those reasons, often a settlement does not reflect the merits of a case, or certainly not closely. And again, this is these are topics that need to be addressed in litigation reform. And sticking with juries makes it more difficult to address.
We've got almost 10 minutes left. We've got another caller with a question. So let's carry on with our questions here.
Hello. This is David Gruning from Loyola Law School in New Orleans. It seems to me that that Professors Lerner and Thomas are talking about two different things. Professor Lerner, or at least two different axes in their two different directions in their comments. It seems Professor Thomas is more interested in the original understanding, the historical understanding of the role of the jury, going back to the end of the 18th century. Whereas Professor Lerner is trying to get us to look more closely at what systems are doing elsewhere in the world, in the civil law world primarily, where there are very few cases where there are single judges. I think there may be almost none. And I think maybe the conversation, I'd like to hear, seems the weakness in Professor Thomas's position is that it ignores what's going on now. There are very few systems being put together today that try to protect individual rights and structure a civil justice system using a jury. And perhaps the weakness in Professor Lerner's position is that it's a little weaker on the originalist side.
Who wants to respond first?
I'll respond. This is Professor Thomas. I think that's a great comment. If the system were to be recreated today, I think that while there are various people within the legal world who might, various, I wouldn't say it's everyone, in fact, I think it'd be quite divided, and possibly equally divided, but if you include practitioners, but I think there would be divided attention given to both judges and juries if we were going to recreate the system. So I think I don't think that if we were to recreate the system that we would actually be where other parts of the world are, and I think that that's part of the beauty of our system. Our system is different, and we do value citizen participation. I very much believe that if we were to poll the general population wants a jury. And so the legal world may be different, but I also believe that if we look at the legal world, that that's going to be very much divided. So I appreciate the question, and I think it's accurate to say that you know, yes, my position is based on an originalist understanding, and it's, I think, based on, you know, what we have now in terms of our Constitution and what our Constitution requires.
Professor Lerner.
It's good to hear from you, David, and as always, a great question. I would say about originalist understanding, the difficulty is that it's almost impossible to return to that 18th century legal system. And this is a problem with procedural rights in general, that they depend on so many other factors besides just the right that is trying to be enshrined in the Constitution. Procedural rights are very easy to evade. They're easy to evade by making changes to other parts of the legal system. And that's what we see here. So in the late 18th century, there was a division between law and equity. The pleading rules and the writ system kept complicated cases from the jury. And I really can't emphasize that enough. That is just was just crucial to the functioning of the jury system. But when law and equity merged, those differences went away. And equity had to be the dominant system of the two when you merge them, because only equity could handle complicated disputes. And I don't hear anyone trying to undo the merger of law and equity. It so obviously makes sense to have a unified legal system rather than two legal systems. And once you merge them, you've really destroyed the conditions for having any kind of reasonable jury trial. And that's the problem. We cannot return to the 18th century jury. Returning to the 18th century jury would mean, among other things, reestablishing that division, but also allowing judges to comment on evidence, for example, sometimes aggressively, as they did to guide juries. And many, many other changes. There were property qualifications for jurors. Jurors were limited to white men, et cetera, et cetera. And it would be very difficult to return to those kinds of distinctions that were important in running the jury system.
We've got just a couple minutes left. Why don't we get offer each of our guests a chance to wrap up with a concluding thought? And let's go in reverse order than we began. So, Professor Thomas, a final thought?
Yeah. I'd say that the jury's in the Constitution. It serves a role to check government. I think if it continues to fall in use, it stops checking the government. And I think it's an important reason to continue to have the government. I'm sorry, the jury. The jury was intended to be part and parcel of the government. It isn't, and I think it should be.
Professor Lern?
I would say it's important to keep in mind, again, the distinction between the criminal and the civil jury. And there may be instances in which we would decide that civil cases should go to juries, or with modifications, I might say. So, for instance, advisory juries, or lay jurors sitting with professional judges in cases involving the government, for example. There's a possibility of that. But in disputes between private parties, and in many, many cases, the downsides of juries just overwhelm any advantages that we might get.
Well, I want to thank both of you. This has been an enlightening discussion. Professor Lerner, Professor Thomas, thank you for joining us today. We certainly appreciate your time. To our audience, thank you for dialing in, and thank you for your thoughtful questions as well. And a reminder to our audience that our next scheduled teleforum conference call will be tomorrow at noon Eastern Time, when we'll get our update on the CFPB. But until that next teleforum call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.